the courage to be vulnerable. Have the courage to know you know nothing. Have the courage to know that only the divine can teach you anything. And if you really open your whole being at that moment in the rubble of your life, and if you really cry out, and if you really long for guidance, and if you really hunger and thirst for righteousness, as Jesus said, if you really, then you will be rewarded. The divine will open a door for you in whatever way is suited to your temperament. You will meet a person further along the path than you do who inspires you, can give you some crucial information. A book will suddenly fall on your head in a library. I hope it's one of mine, actually, because I don't want it to be, you know, the Book of Miracles or something, but the spirit works in mysterious ways. One of Llewellyn's would be a very good idea, too. A book will fall on top of you, or you'll have a series of amazing dreams. Or like me, you'll be an arrogant, wasted, depressed 25-year-old lying on a bed in India, wondering why the hell he's come back to India, loathing all the white-clothed, soft-voiced ashramites around you. And one day, thinking that they were all just eating the cud of the land and doing absolutely nothing about anything, a not inaccurate picture, actually, of many of them, lying on a bed and suddenly, without any warning, being transported into a cloud of dazzling, brilliant light where a million voices were singing, I love you to the beloved, and then singing, I hate to leave you, but I have to go, and then coming down a huge black chute and arriving back as myself, knowing in every cell of my body that where I and everyone else was birthed from was from light origin, and where I was going back to was to light origin. These experiences are given to shatter the past and to open up what is the first station of the path, what I call falling in love. Because at that moment, when that being or those dreams or that vision has opened up for you a wholly new possibility, an outrageous possibility, you suddenly begin to realize that what the mystics are talking about is not some kind of highfalutin poetry. It is literally another life. Another existence filled with a power and a fire and a beauty and an enormous passion, which you now know is real because it's starting to move inside you. It's moving inside you as energy. It's moving inside you as strange, exalted feelings, both of pain and of rapture in your heart. It's moving inside you as the desire to pray. Pray in ways that you've never prayed before. It's moving inside you as the tears that fall when you read Rumi or Hafiz or Kabir. It's moving inside you and you know it's real. And at that moment comes the first great danger of the path. And that first great danger is that you mistake these tiny embryonic beginnings for total overwhelming enlightenment, which is what a great many seekers out there, because they don't know the stations, are doing. And in fact, it's what nearly all of us do in what this period is, which is really the honeymoon period. God gives you a great many cigarettes before the torture begins. If you know the path, and if someone has taken the trouble to spell out the rigor of the path to you, you won't be tempted to believe that voice inside you which says, as it once said to me in Germany on the top of a hill, poor old Jesus. He struggled so hard, but he never knew anything like this. And the Buddha was a very noble, high-minded person, but poor chap, he never felt these kinds of overwhelming ecstasies. He felt them right at the beginning, which is when I felt them. And had I not had some learning in the path, that voice, with my natural tendency to exaggerate, would have swept me away. What then has to happen is this. And Ramakrishna puts it beautifully. He says, at this stage, what you really are is a little sapling that has just appeared above the ground, a little rosebush, if you like, that has just appeared above the ground. And what you need to do, as these experiences open in you, is to build a fence around that sapling to protect it. And what that fence consists of is prayer and meditation and service. Prayer to unite you in adoration with the beloved. Meditation to bring some calm to the turbulence of your schizophrenic ego, which will become more and more schizophrenic as the self tries to assert itself against its demands. And service to constantly remind you of the aim of the path on which you are going. And if you combine and fuse those three things, your fence will become strong enough for the sapling really to grow. And your sincerity will be tested by the beloved. And if the beloved finds you really sincere and really longing for the next transformation, you will be graced what all seekers are graced as a reward for true sincerity, which is you will be graced with a real major ordeal. On the real path, real sincerity is tested not so much by blisses and visions and awakening experiences. They come even to the insincere, sometimes especially to the insincere, who then capitalize on them for the rest of their lives and make everybody else feel small because they haven't seen the rotating lights and the angels appearing in blue and white and red. What really tests a seeker, and this goes for the whole of the rest of the path, is how they stand up to and embrace the necessary ordeals of purification that come the whole length of the path and go on and on coming in ever subtler forms, because there is always work to do on the real path. The first great purification of the path is known in all of the mystical traditions, and it's known in many of them as the purification of the senses. Because what has to happen at this moment is that each of your senses has to be penetrated by adoration, penetrated by rapture, penetrated by the divine light of consciousness, penetrated by radical humility, so that each of those senses can be transformed from within, and each of them can become not the instruments of the false self, which is what they are in normal reality, creating division and separation, but the instruments of the divine self, consciously looking out at an increasingly divine world, hearing divine music in the streams running, seeing divine reality in the flowering of a rose, seeing the real as the manifestation of the one. To be able to do that, each of the senses has to be rinsed in flame. And this first purification is very tough. Often you lose a great deal of weight, your whole life is spun into total bewilderment, and your only hope, and this is why spiritual practice is so essential, you can't do anything on this path without a rigorous, humble daily practice, because when you come to the purifications, what you'll need is to be able to stand there and, despite everything that's going on inside you and around you, saying, I trust you, I love you, I cling on to you, I believe in you, and I know that what feels like death is really resurrection, and I know that what's eating me is remaking me. And how can you stand there with that kind of courage and that kind of fidelity and that kind of rigor unless you have really built a practice of prayer and meditation and service so solidly in the core of your life that when your entire being is shaken to be remade, you know who's shaken it, and you know that the being who was giving you all those blisses and visions and that gorgeous honeymoon is now preparing you for the first of the great fiery purifications. If you get through this first purification, and not many seekers really do complete the first stage, this is the truth, and it is a great thing in this life to complete that first stage. If you do complete that first stage by surrendering completely and in total trust to the beloved, then an enormous experience completes the first stage, completes the first journey, which the Sufis call the journey to God, and begins the astounding and never-ending journey in God. And that experience is this one. Very slowly during the period of purification, your senses are being so cleansed by your adoration and by the pressure of divine grace that slowly the light starts to come up in reality. The light that my friends saw that morning in Auschwitz starts to appear. It starts to appear in flashes, then in halos, then in auras, and then slowly, 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 it becomes more and more of a normal reality, so that you only have to stand and consecrate, and there it is. And then one marvelous day, one astounding day, one miraculous day, the universe itself just explodes quietly, and what you see is that all things out there are dancing in the heart fire in here, and all atoms are out of their minds with love for this dancing fire, and that you and the fire and God are one, 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 one forever and that you are that and you are this. And that experience is not enlightenment. It has been confused with enlightenment. It is not enlightenment. Let me get one thing completely clear to you. There is no such thing as complete, total, final enlightenment. There is such a thing as an enlightenment field which you enter, but because love is infinite, the transformations that are wrought in that field are also infinite. And they go on not just in this body, but in all the bodies that we will have in all of the worlds. And even the highest angels, even Gabriel, even the seraphim and the cherubim are being transformed at every second into deeper extensions of themselves by the love that is drawing them ever upward and ever onward. So all human pretensions to total enlightenment are just that. They are human pretensions, manipulations of other people in the name of power. They have nothing to do with the authentic mystic reality. And if you want to find that written down, turn to Rumi, who said, "Don't you understand that the path isn't arriving? The path is getting so thirsty that wherever you are, you thirst for more so that more can be given to you. Even if you are an angel, thirst, thirst." And then a miracle which I do not know and cannot explain will happen, because the transformation field begins when the light dawns in your mind and you know forever that you are eternal, that you are immortal, and that everything that Lao Tzu and the Upanishads and Rumi and Hafiz and the whole gang of them ever said about reality is nothing less than the total and complete truth. But this is only the beginning of the second station. And this station I call engagement. After falling in love, things have to get a bit more serious. And engagement is when the light starts acting directly in you and partly as you. And this is a totally astonishing stage. At this stage, what happens? The light comes into you and comes into you directly and nakedly. And what it gives you are extraordinary powers, powers that seem divine and miraculous to the people around you, powers of creativity, powers of charisma, powers of phenomenal insight, powers sometimes of being able to heal, powers of appearing in other people's dreams, powers actually of manifesting the divine light around you, real powers, powers that give you the semblance of a divine presence. And I use the word semblance very, very, very purposefully. Because just as the first stage has a tremendous danger, the danger of inflation, so this stage has an even greater danger, which many, many people who get to this stage embrace with voluptuous adoration. And this danger is very simply this. You are always at this stage tempted in terms of your own personality and in terms of your full self's deepest desire to use all the powers that are being given to you by God, not for the glory of God, but for your own use, for your own fame, for your own sex, drugs, rock and roll, and bank account. And that temptation is most classically represented, of course, in the temptation of Jesus after the awakening. Jesus awoke to his divine nature, had the light experience at the baptism, and was crowned the Son of God, just as we all will be at that moment. Then what happens? Immediately these new powers have come. He has the tremendous sober horse sense to go into the desert, into solitude, to integrate these powers. And immediately with that tremendous attempt to ground the powers in true love, the shadow, the tempter, the dark one appears and says, "You have the power now to do miracles. You have the power to impress people with your pseudo-divinity. You have the power to manipulate millions of people. You have the charisma, you have all of this. Why don't you do it? It's a fabulous life. You don't have to go and be miserable down there. You can have a villa next to Herod's in Tiberias and live until you're 88 and have people adoring you and believing you that you're totally awake. Why go through all the rubbish of actually being awake?" And Jesus's supreme courage, and the courage that you will require at that stage, is to really say what he said, which is, "Get thee behind me." And it's when he's saying "get thee behind me," he's also talking to a part of himself that was listening. And that part has to be put aside. And that part is always the still neurotic part, the shadow part, the hurt part that longs either for power or for success or for sexual gratification or for a combination of all three or to appear amazing and special, because that part will sabotage your whole path if you succumb to it. And that is, of course, what the majority of the gurus have done. And that is a very important piece of information. And I want to read out what I wrote in The Direct Path, because unless you know that you can appear divine and you can manipulate people with so-called divine powers at this stage, but that is not a divine act, but actually a dark act, the whole of this spiritual renaissance will be endangered by its false innocence. And that is why I have made a very deep point of it, drawing on the true mystical traditions, the true Sufi writings about black magic. Rumi was absolutely unexampled in his ferocious rage against those who did this kind of thing, and so was Ramakrishna, and so was St. Francis, and so have all the great mystics been who have seen the end of the path. And this is what I wrote. The ferocity, danger, and extent of this temptation is known in all the secret traditions. They know that the stage of engagement can endow you with extraordinary occult powers that can tempt you to mimic the divine before others and to perform what others in lesser states of evolution will call miracles, but which are really displays of natural spiritual force. These occult powers are well known to include clairvoyance, telepathy, the ability to read each other's minds and transmit thoughts and inner messages and appear in others' dreams, the capacity to emit or manifest divine light and to change, shift, or in some way transform objects, and the force to compel others to give you money, sex, or to adore and follow you slavishly. Does this sound familiar to anybody? The power to do specifically black magic and so to maim physically or even physically destroy others may also be given at this stage. And if you choose to exercise these powers in any way for your own advantage, the traditions warn, you will join the ranks of the demonic, and through your perversion of the gifts of God will forfeit not only your spiritual development, but also your soul. Most of those the New Age calls enlightened gurus are not divine or divinized beings at all, but powerful and unscrupulous occult manipulators who, from the point of view of authentic mystical tradition, are not only not in any way enlightened, but spiritually on a lower rung even than murderers or child molesters, because they have chosen to use the highest divine gifts for worldly power and influence. And if you don't know that out in that spiritual jungle there are real wolves in sheep's clothing, and if you don't know that there are beings powerful enough to appear as angels while having very dark designs on you, and if you don't know that these occult powers are real and will be given to you at a certain moment in the path when you are ready to be tempted by them, then all of this will come as an overwhelming shock and surprise to you, and you'll be so tempted that it will be very, very hard not to give in, because the way in which the dark can mimic the light at the higher stages of the path becomes ever subtler and demands ever greater powers of discrimination to be able to see and survive. Am I making myself ruthlessly clear? What happens then? If you have the wild courage to say no to these temptations that are offered you, to really cry with your whole being, "Get thee behind me," to that part of yourself that is tempted, what you will be rewarded by is the supreme ordeal of the path. And this is recognized in all of the true traditions, and in the Sufi tradition, one of its names, as you would expect, is the test of the cross. It is known as fana, as annihilation. In the first purification, what has to happen is that the senses have to be rinsed in flame to become able to hold the divine experience. But that experience still leaves the false self intact in the way that I've described, still leaves it temptable. If you prove that that false self really, that you really want that false self to die, then what will be created for you in the inferno and crucible of your life will be the circumstances that will force and compel and drive that false self to die. In fact, as Rumi says, what will happen is that in the last mercy of final love, agonies will crowd you from all directions so that you have nowhere to go but into the directionless. This is an inescapable part of the path. And one of the supreme lies, and it is a filthy and obscene and blasphemous lie of many of the so-called New Age versions of the path, is that they try to cushion this blow to the false self. There is no way out of death, because there's no way out, finally, of love. And love and death come together, because you have to die into becoming love, to be love in its full glory and in its full splendor. And if you want the most accurate, the most pungent, the most rigorous, the fiercest and the cleanest and the most unbelievably unsentimental statement of this central law of the path, who better to turn to than really the source and fountain of the whole Sufi revelation, behind and beyond everything in its later developments, that is, Muhammad himself. I don't know if you're aware that Muhammad gave many hadiths, many secret sayings, that in a very distilled way, like the Jesus of the Gospel of Thomas, gives the essence of the essence of the essence of the essence of the mystic path to those who are able to hear. And this hadith is one that always takes my breath away, because it stabs me in the gut with the truth of the real death that must happen for life in its splendor to be born. This is God speaking. Whoever seeks me finds me, and whoever finds me comes to know me, and whoever comes to know me loves me. And whoever loves me, then I kill that person. And whomsoever I kill, I must pay the blood money. And to whomsoever I owe the blood money, then I am the recompense for. That is the whole truth of the upper reaches of the path. That the point of the path is to learn enough trust, stand strong in enough sacred practice, deepen your meditation enough, so that when the great whirlwind of annihilation descends upon you, and when you are strapped to the cross of your false self and compelled to live through each protracted horror and agony of its crucifixion, then you will not waver. You will trust the Lord, because you will know those lines in the core of your being, that what is sent as a series of catastrophes, and believe me, there is very little as terrifying as this period. It goes far beyond any trauma or any horror or any despair or any heartbreak, because it is suffered in the very core of your mystic consciousness. It is suffered with horrible and final lucidity. When that suffering comes, you will know one great truth, and that will save you. You will know that it is the final mercy that is coming as death itself. It is the final release, the final birth that is coming in all of this madness. Let me tell you a story. I worked with Eva Devitre Meyerovich on Rumi and with Rumi. She was a true crackpot, for which I am eternally grateful. I would have hated a half crackpot to learn Rumi with. One side of Eva was this quiet little dumpy French woman pretending to be an academic, which was very important in the days that she translated Rumi, because had she been Eva number two, nobody would ever let her publish anything. Eva number two was somebody madly in love with the Sufi revelation, madly in love with Rumi, who talked about Rumi in the present tense. Even I don't talk about Rumi in the present tense. Not yet, anyway. And one day, I went to see her on November the 29th to do some work. The date is important. I opened the door, and there was Ava standing like Jessica Tandy in a hurricane in the doorway. And I thought, my God, Ava, what's going on? And she said, don't you know what it is? Don't you know what day it is? You claim to love Rumi and you don't know what day it is. This is the day he met Shams almost certainly, and this is the day he met his death. It was rather a dramatic way to be met on a French cold afternoon, but it got madder. Because then she started to scream and to howl. And it was as if she was enacting everything that was going to follow on that meeting with Shams. Everything that was inevitable once he'd met the great love in his life. And she cried out, why did he have to go through all of this? Why did he have to suffer all this? It's intolerable! It's intolerable that anybody should be made to be burnt in so extreme a fire so that we can have this fountain after fountain of gnosis. I weep for him. And it was so beautiful because just as the Christian mystics weep for the sacrifice of Christ, weep for that extremity of self-giving so that they can find in the depths of themselves the power to do a sacrifice as great. So what she was doing was crying out and keening and lamenting the real price of the real path. The real path, which is when I love somebody, I kill that person. And she said that when she first went to Konya, she had been overtaken by the same rage against God, the same scream against God. Why did you have to make him suffer so much so that we could be so blessed? Why did he have to be stripped and burnt and peeled and trampled and ground in the way that he was and humiliated? Why? And she spent 4 days in her hotel room, absolutely out of her mind with rage, saying, all this Sufism is rubbish and bunk. I hate it. I wish I'd never heard about mysticism. I'm going to go back and drink and eat myself to death and read Trollope. And then she eventually went to the tomb. And she came out still unassuaged. And she sat down and put on her shoes next to a little old man. And that little old man turned to her and said, you still do not know, do you? And she wept. And she wept. And she said, but help me. Just help me. Give me an image that will help me understand. And he pointed to one of the rose bushes in the garden in Konya. And he said, look at that rose. Is it a very beautiful, very unique, very gorgeous rose? She said, yes. Is it totally open? She said, yes. Can you smell its fragrance even from where we are sitting? She said, yes. And then he said, now imagine what it took to become that rose. Imagine being cut from an original rose bush. Imagine being planted down deep in the darkness of ignorance, in the darkness of matter, in the darkness of the earth. Imagine the wrestling in the darkness to drink in the nutrients that were coming so that you could rise. Imagine the first struggles of that rose. Imagine how it struggled to grow. Imagine how it had to learn how each thorn was necessary for the protection of its life, how it had to grow those thorns. Imagine what effort it took. Imagine what effort it took to grow those branches. And imagine then the further effort, the further striving, the further yearning, the further raptures that went into the growth of the buds. And then he turned to her and he said, what has to happen to a bud before it can become a fully open, fully generous, fully complete rose? And suddenly she got it. It has to be broken open. Otherwise, all those infolded revelations and visions and insights that are juicily, secretly hidden within the bud cannot do what they have to do for the full gift to be given, which is to open completely in serene individual magnificence so that the entire gift can then be given wholly and completely. And Ava was feeling testy, which was not unusual. And she said, that's a very pretty image, but we're talking about crucifixion here, so give me another image. And he smiled. And he said to her, he was in his 80s, he said, you know, when my time of killing came, I felt like you. I felt outraged and horror-struck. And I came to this tomb, and I begged the one who knew the way of love for a real sign that would give me courage. Nothing happened. And I gave up going to the tomb, and one day I happened to be visiting a baker near the tomb in the late afternoon, and I saw a woman writhing and screaming and howling and hollering on the pavement. I was petrified. She'd been stabbed. Some unknown assailant had killed her. Something appalling was happening. Her whole body seemed to be writhing in an agony beyond all imagining. And then suddenly, she parted her legs, and in the middle of the street, a child appeared. And out of all of that agony, which I'd interpreted as death, a wholly new, extraordinary life was being born. And I helped her give birth to the child. I cut its umbilical cord, and she sat in the middle of the road with her skirt bloody and people stricken with curiosity all around her. The agony that she'd been through transformed into tears of gratitude and bliss, because the life inside her, the divine child within her, had at last been born. And even Eva couldn't find much fault with that. What happens then, through the logic of the path, is that this great ordeal leads through a crucifixion to a real resurrection. And the only way that I can possibly describe what this is like to you is by reading to you a poem that comes straight out of this sublime consciousness. And of course, it's Rumi, because what is absolutely astonishing is that in Rumi we have somebody who lived 30 years in this consciousness, lavishing a whole vision of the whole path from it, shirking nothing, but opening up all the ordeals onto the splendor that you will now hear for yourself. And if this doesn't persuade you that anything is worth it that leads to this, there is nothing on earth that I can say, or in heaven that anyone else can say. I see now, with my open eyes, that this entire world is the form of universal reason, which is the father-mother of all lovers of the divine word. Go on raging and being ungrateful towards the beloved, and nothing will change. Make your peace with your beloved. Abandon disobedience, and this world's water and clay will appear like a gold carpet, and resurrection will become your immediate experience, and heaven and earth will be transfigured in your living eyes. Since I have come by grace to be always at peace with my beloved, the world always appears like a paradise to me. At each moment, a new form and new beauty appear, and their glory dissolves all fear and boredom, and I see the world radiant and brimming with magnificence, the waters constantly flowing from the springs of heaven. The sound of these waters is always enchanting my ears. My deepest mind and consciousness reel with bliss. The branches of the trees dance for me like penitents. I see leaves everywhere, clapping their hands like musicians. The mirror's shining seeps through its velvet sheath. Just imagine the blaze when the mirror itself appears. And what he's referring to in that last two lines is the great experience that actually ends the crucifixion, which is the experience of the entire world vanishing into the sun and reappearing utterly saturated with the sun and as rays of the sun. And at that moment, the false self is dead and the divine self is born. But there is one last temptation. And many of the mystical maps out there do not warn you of this temptation, and so hobble the path at the moment when it can become truly splendid and truly useful. And that temptation is what I call the temptation to transcendence. You see, when you've seen the world disappear into the sun and reappear as rays of the sun, a part of you is tempted to dismiss this reality as unreal and as a dream, and to want to be only one with that sun. And that is a fatal mistake. Because what wanting to escape this reality into the reality that is birthing it always makes impossible is the flooding of this reality with the divine powers that are given to you from the divine self. So if you use those powers and those visions and those revelations simply to thirst and hunger after a transcendent freedom from everything, then the world remains what it has always been, a sink of cruelty and meanness and injustice, and nothing real is transfigured. And that is one of the deepest reasons why, for all the great mystical explorations of all the great mystical traditions, for all of the great saints who meditated on one leg at the top of mountains, for all the tremendous scriptures that have been given us, we're still at a stage when 2 billion people spend their days scavenging for food on rubbish heaps, and when we are burning the whole world to death in our greed. So something is very badly wrong with that picture, and it is something that the greatest of all the traditions, the Rumis and the Ramakrishnas and the Jesuses, have always grasped. And that is this, very simply, that at this stage when you are tempted to go off into transcendence, what you must cling to is the motherhood of God. And what you must cling to is the mother's love for her own creation, the feminine's adoration of reality as a real manifestation of the real divine. And what you must give your life to is a tremendous service of the mother, in the mother, as a part of the motherhood of God, to all beings that are still burning in the fires of cruelty and madness and injustice. And if you don't do that, you have taken the final temptation to power, the temptation to escape, the final drug that really does work this time, the final heroin, and you have used it not to make you more embattled to be a warrior for justice, to be a servant of divine love in action in the world. You have taken it for the cheap delight of your own freedom, which is not a real freedom, because the only real freedom lies in the absolute and final surrender to the passion of divine love for justice and creativity and transformation of the real world and its real conditions. And this is what I wrote in The Direct Path. The complete realization of your divine nature, then, must contain an embrace of the motherhood of God that created the creation and sustains it with infinite love, infinite humility, infinite self-sacrifice, and tireless action. This is at once a very complete and a very frightening demand, because it involves an embrace of the conditions of the world and the world nature in all its complexity, ambiguity, and potential for destructiveness. You cannot hide anymore anywhere. You cannot hide in transcendence. All your awareness of the transcendent has to be employed in making you calmer, stronger, more and more committed, integrated, humble and wild within the whirlwind of the world. In choosing to love and be one with the motherhood of God, you choose, in fact, to embrace the suffering of struggling for the transformation of real conditions in the world, and the suffering of constant labor and disappointment, even defeat. You put your entire being constantly at risk in the name of divine love and for its sake and for its victory in the real. You become, at last, a gambler for love and justice in the core of a dangerous world. And what you gamble with is your life. So where you're being taken to is not a place of omnipotent transcendent awareness where you can simply sit on your futon as the world burns to death. I am sorry to inform you of this news, because There's a part of every single one of us that longs for that. And I'd like to end with a story. If you give me 5 more minutes, I may be able to reveal to you how this has come to me. No one comes to this realization of servitude without great grief. And that great grief is necessary because it destroys the last clingings of the subtle ego to power. I've just been in India. I went for 2 glorious months to the south where I was born, and I spent those months going from Shiva temple to Shiva temple, drinking in the amazing power and passion of the Hindu vision of the sacred masculine. Wouldn't it have changed all of our minds if we'd had a flamboyant, sexual, passionate Jesus instead of the enervated hysteric that they have given to us? Shiva and Jesus have a lot to give each other. In South India, there is a hill, a mountain called Arunachala. And this mountain is revered as Shiva himself, as the fire lingam of Shiva himself. It is infinitely sacred, and it is considered so holy that even to mention its name or to think of it, or to turn towards it in meditation, is to be assured of total liberation. And saints and mystics and hermits, including Ramana Maharshi, have lived on it. And you only have to go on it to feel the naked, throbbing power of what emanates from it. And I decided that I would go there, and I decided that it was time that I had a total awakening. Naturally, I had decided that. And I had decided that it was time that I had it in exactly the way that I wanted, which was to be totally sprung free, to be baptized in eternal being, to be given finally the sense of a complete closure with all illusion. That's the way I put it to myself. And I wrote it all down because naturally I would. I went to Arunachala. Everything seemed to be going to plan. I was in an amazing state of joy. Bliss was pouring through every vein. I went and sat down on the mountain and found that I was sitting near the cave where Ramana Maharshi had achieved one of his greatest realizations, and I thought, of course, this must be a sign. And then I decided that I would do the walk at night around the mountain, because that would be the time, wouldn't it? When this enormous bliss that would finally seal me off as the eternal child of God would descend. And I thought perhaps about 3 o'clock in the morning would be an appropriate time for this to happen. Have any of you ever played games with God like this? Goes on, doesn't it? And it was quite a serious game because, you know, calling out for transcendent being is not an unserious thing. And I also believed the mountain could grant it. I really did, because the first time I ever saw the mountain, I saw it leap like a flame. It just did it. And I thought, well, that's a sign. Andrew Harvey will lose Andrew Harvey here. Ha. What happened was this. I started on the night journey. Everything was going wonderfully. I decided to do it in the traditional way without shoes. Suddenly, I realized that on this journey with me to my transcendence were thousands of miserable people. Thousands of poor people, and they all came up to me and one after one told me of their misery. And I was trying to concentrate on bliss. I was trying to concentrate on this great peace that Arunachala was, and an old woman came and said, I have no money for medicine, give me something, I have this terrible disease. And a young man showed me the scar of his operation and said, all I need is $10 a month and I don't have it, otherwise I will die. And the boy that was accompanying me around the station was saying, I've been trying for years to bring aid to my village where I can build a school for these kids who have no education. And the last time I tried, I had a friend who ran away with all of the money and is living in some beach colony down in the south. It is all corrupt. Everything is corrupt. And this litany of pain, of rage, of corruption, of misery kept going on. And I found myself in myself getting furious. How dare you interfere with my bliss? How dare you interfere with my transcendence, with your pitiful repetition of the misery of the world? And it's so horrible when you face that in yourself.